Welcome back, everyone. I hope everyone enjoyed yesterday and found those considerations to be helpful. Hopefully it maybe have disturbed you a little bit. That's our job, is to disturb the comfort and comfort the disturbed. We'll start off this morning with the set-aside prayer again. It's always a good way to start these sessions. I find it very useful. Especially after being around for a long time, the ego tends to think it knows a lot because it's got a lot of information, and I really struggle sometimes to set that aside, so there's no better way of doing that than asking your higher power to do that. So we'll start off with the set-aside prayer, so you can all say it together. God, please set aside everything I think I know about myself, the steps, the big book, sobriety in you. Please help me to have an open mind. May have new experience, discover the truth.
Good. All right, good morning all. My name's Peter, I'm an alcoholic. And welcome back. It was so encouraging to see a lot of people with their text guides open and filling it out at breakfast and getting in amongst it and soaking up what this weekend's about. This session, we're going to just do a quick little recap on the first three steps, do a third step prayer together as a collective, as a group, and then I'll introduce the information for the fourth step. So we'll probably go to about 10 o'clock. Hopefully by 10 o'clock we've got through the resentment and fears instructions to set that down, and have a 10-minute break, come back. We'll cover off on the sex harms inventory, step five, and then there's free time. And the free time is set there for everybody to do some inventory. You guys can maybe have a little bit of a dilly-dally around with it, get a taste for what it's about. People that have been around for some time will have an opportunity to get current with whatever's going on today, to become unblocked. And so that, and then, so that will be whatever time we finish, maybe around 11, something like that, perhaps. Then there'll be lunch in the middle there somewhere. And then when we reconvene this afternoon, whatever time that will be, at about 2:30-ish, between the last session this morning and then, hopefully, we've all done some inventory. We've found a recovery partner. And we've sat down and we've got entirely honest with that person about what's going on. And so we will have done step five in a physical sense with somebody else that we choose to do it with here today. I would encourage everybody to do that. And then after lunch, we'll come back together. After that, we'll come back together. We'll talk about six and seven. By the end of today, we want to get to the end of step nine. And then tonight, we've got a campfire meeting. Which will be a spitfire meeting where we'll rapidly try and rotate through as many of you guys as we can. We've got a guest speaker who turned 50 years sober during the week. He'll do a guest share, and then we'll try and rotate through everybody. People who don't get a chance, an opportunity to share tonight, will hopefully get an opportunity. We'll definitely get an opportunity to share tomorrow at the wrap up meeting. So we'll have a list so that everybody will have an opportunity to participate in the weekend, as well as participate in the process of going through the 12 steps. So last night, I described last night as the setup. You know, it's a setup for trying to get to a point that I'm asked to do some heavy lifting, and the heavy lifting is the action steps, and the action steps are 4 through to 9. And we went through the first three steps last night, and Chris, you know, very well described the kind of person that I am by using the analogy that Wilson put down of that actor and how that hasn't worked. and that my problem is that I'm an extreme example of self-will run riot. So if I think about the chart that's behind me somewhere, we call that a road chart to a decision, and it really kind of outlines where it is that I'm currently at. Step one identifies the problem. And the problem we tried to outline last night, as I said, we cherry-picked, jumped from here to there to whatever in the book to try and just pull out some points. Other people might have chose different points. Doesn't much matter. there's not enough time to cover everything that we would have liked to. But what that outlined was that I've got an allergic reaction to alcohol, happens when I drink it, and I've got a mental obsession, a mind that will drive me back to drink when I'm sober. And on page 45, you know, he summed that up in three words. He said, lack of power. That's my problem. I don't have the power to stop that from happening. So if the problem's powerlessness, then the second step's got to be about power. How do I find that power? And I think I read eight short sentences out of We Agnostics that absolutely defines what the book was about. Its main object was to enable me to find that power. And that power is a power greater than myself. And the solution was that personality change to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And so the solution comes in sort of two parts, if you like. It's a vital spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, this personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism that happens as a consequence of the 12 steps. And then that's supported by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's two components, if you like. And out of that, hopefully, I'll find a power greater than myself. And we talked a little bit about where that power is going to be found. It's not out there. It's going to be found within me. That connection's already within me. I just need to become unblocked to be open to that. And then the third step is where I get to make a decision. And the third step is a decision step that I'm going to try and make a decision to engage that new manager, to engage that power. The third step, prayer, is a formalization of that decision. So I just wanted to go through very quickly just a couple of things before we actually do the prayer together. The third step says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And I like that. I like the term turn. It doesn't say that I hand things over. It says that I turn. There's a language in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not saying that it's right, wrong or otherwise. Please, I'm not saying that. Because a lot of people use it. They say, I hand it over, hand it over, hand it over. My thought process behind that is if I hand something over, I'm totally unresponsible now and I don't need to worry about it. Whereas I think that the term turn is that I'm turning to. And I'm turning to and I'm asking for help. I'm turning to and saying, all right, I can't do this on my own. I need some help here. I'm turning to, and that's the metaphor, I think, of you know, what I'm kind of asked to do here. I'm trying to, you know, if Alcoholics Anonymous stands, you know, if we use the acronym of altered attitudes, you know, an attitude in aeronautical terms is that I'm changing my angle of approach because my angle of approach is incorrect. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to turn to and change my angle of approach to how I've lived my life up to this point, because if Alcoholics Anonymous is an evidence-based program, I need to look at what my life was an evidence-based program when I got here. Nobody was asking me to write a book of how well I was going, and geez, we really want what you've got. So it clearly it was not working well. In your handout, I put a piece in there which was just an extract from the original manuscript to try and highlight a point here. And this was how Wilson wrote it before he workshopped it out to the however many people were involved in the writing and the changing and the editing of the textbook of the day. And I'm just going to start in the paragraph above the three pertinent ideas. And it goes like this. I'll read it. It says, and you'll note it's different to how it is in your actual textbook. He says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. C, that God can and will. Now, there's not a lot of change there in what's in the actual textbook. But the paragraph that was taken out, and this is a paragraph that I want to read, and I want to read it just to try and highlight a point. This was in the original manuscript. He says, if you are not convinced on these vital issues, he referred to the three pertinent ideas as vital issues. He says, if you're not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. Reread the book to this point or else throw it away. I need to think about it again. Well, what are the vital issues? The vital issues are steps one and two. He's saying, if I'm not convinced of steps one and two, I ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away. There's no point going any further. So, if I'm not convinced of the first step, if I'm not convinced of the problem, I'm certainly not going to be looking for a solution to the problem. If I've rejected the first step, I'm not going to be interested in trying to find a solution to a problem that I don't have. That may be my dilemma. So there's no point going any further. He says either reread the book to this point or else throw it away. If I'm not convinced of the first step and I reread the book, I take that route. I might find something in the book that I missed the first time when I went through it the first time. I might find something like a line in there which would be something that people might be astonished that's in the basic textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous, because don't forget, this is Alcoholics Anonymous and this is about stopping drinking, and I might be astonished to find a line that might go along, well, we don't like to pronounce anybody alcoholic, but you can soon diagnose yourself. Step across the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try and drink and stop abruptly. Try it more than once. He says it may be worth a bad case of the jitters to get a full knowledge of your condition. You see, if I'm not convinced I'm an alcoholic, the only thing that's going to convince me is by drinking and proving that I'm non-alcoholic. Now, I'm not saying that anybody needs to do that here, but the premise of what he's written in that paragraph there suggests that if I'm not convinced of those three vital ideas, of the three vital issues, or the three pertinent ideas that he named it in the actual print that we use today, if I'm not convinced that I'm alcoholic, there's only one thing that's going to convince me. My job in Alcoholics Anonymous, as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, as a person who tries to work and help others, is not to convince them that they're alcoholic, but to share my experience, strength and hope. The only thing that convinces anybody that they're alcoholic is themselves trying to drink and stop abruptly, trying to control and enjoy. Experience of not being able to handle alcohol is the thing that convinces people. I'm not here to try and talk anybody out of it. I'm just trying to share experience, and that way hopefully they match that experience. So let's take it the other way. Let's say, you know what, I'm absolutely convinced I'm alcoholic. I've 100% conceded to my innermost self. I've got that 100%. There's no problem. And we recounted various things through the book yesterday where information doesn't keep me sober. Being surrendered to the fact that I'm alcoholic, Wilson did it, and he stepped out from the hospital trembling, despairing, you know, and thought that this was it. Self-knowledge would fix him, and he was off again. And understanding what alcoholism is doesn't solve the problem. What solves the problem is trying to find a solution to that problem. So I'm convinced. I'm alcoholic. I've fully conceded to my own self. I have no problem with step one. But you know what? I really don't like that step two stuff. I'm really not quite across that. This power greater than yourself. I mean, really? What are you guys talking about? God. I mean, what is this, church? Really, I'm okay with AA and the stories and everything, but when you start talking about that, I really. So I'm not across the premise of the second step. I reject it. I'm not convinced of that as being a vital issue in my life. I'm not across it. Again, I either reread the book to this point or else throw it away, because I need to find a solution. If I reread the book to that point, I might find somewhere in We're Agnostics that might say, well, there's only one thing that's going to convince me of the existence of God, and it's being beaten into a state of reasonableness. And he says it may be a tedious process, but we hope that some of you will not be as prejudiced for as long as some of us were. I used to listen, and he'd remember her. There was this old girl, Dandy Jean, used to say, if God drives you out, whiskey will drive you straight back in. I used to think, you're an idiot. Why would you say that? But that's exactly what convinces me of having an open mind. And so if, you know, and And the preparation to that third step of coming to that point of making an informed decision. It says in the 12 and 12 that the first couple of steps require no action. They just require me to, you know, have a firm acceptance and understanding of that so that that going forward I can do something. I mentioned yesterday that it was five times throughout the book that he gives me a couple of alternatives. Well, maybe this, maybe that, maybe whatever. He says, we had but one of two alternatives, and one of them one was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation, and the other was to accept spiritual help. In other words, drink, continue drinking and see how that works, or accept spiritual help. Another time he said, well, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. So up until the third step, he's given me alternatives. What do you want? You want step one? You want step two? What do you want to do? So five times he actually works me. He gets me back and forward and back and forward. And Chris said it last night. You know, you want door one or you want door two? There ain't door three. You know, AA is not here to try and convince me of the existence of God, but through a series of situations, it causes me to change my mind based on the circumstances. It's like being thrown out of an aeroplane with a parachute. I don't believe in parachutes, but I don't care whether you believe or you don't. You might want to change your mind based on the circumstances. You're falling out of an aeroplane. Use the ripcord, you know? And that's what AA does. The first step sets that up. The first step sets up the predicament that, listen, I don't care whether you believe or don't believe, but I said last night, I just have to be willing to believe, to be suspicious. You know, as soon as I've got that willingness, honesty and open-mindedness, he said, we emphatically assure you, you're on your way. So step three is that informed decision that I'm standing, you know, he says we stood at the turning point. The turning point is like a roundabout. I've got two ways out of it. Doomed to an alcoholic death or accept spiritual help. It should be straightforward, but it ain't. I wonder how long an alcoholic death would take. I mean, it will be long. I mean, how long have I got? You know, you would think it's academic, but it's not. I need to make that decision, and that third step is that decision. It's formalised with a prayer. and from the prayer, I'm then asked to do the work. So are we okay to do the third step prayer? Everyone across the three pertinent ideas. If we're across the three pertinent ideas and we want to do a third step prayer, what we would do is we're going to form a circle. We're going to hop down on our knees and just test how hard the floor is. We're going to lock hands and we're going to say it together. Let's do it.
Just quickly. So remember the third step I talked about last night, that there's a criteria, and the criteria is I've got to be convinced that my life run on self-will hasn't been successful. I've got to quit playing God. And then I make that decision. And then only an alcoholic would say, okay, here's the prayer, say the prayer, but and then finish it off saying, oh, by the way, here's the conditions of that prayer. He tells us what to do after the prayer. And the conditions are that we say it with someone who understands. And it's important if you're working with people, you don't want to do it with somebody who don't understand. I think we tick that box here. I think everyone pretty much understands in the room that what it is they're about to do. And the other criteria is that they've got to voice it without reservation. Okay, so think about that when we're getting in a circle. Are you going to be willing to voice it without reservation? It's important criteria to think about, but I just laugh. Yeah, he puts it in after we've said the prayer. Well, you're telling me how to say it after I've done the prayer, so it's important to think about. So, yeah, thanks, Floyd. Right.
Guys, are we good to go?
Yep.
Lock hands. Let's do it together. God,
I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may be witness to those who would help. Thy power, thy love, thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
Good job, guys. Good. So as Chris said, we found it desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person. Throws out a few ideas to what that understanding person might look like. I think, you know, when I have the opportunity to take it in a collective, I'm taking it in a collective of many understanding persons. And hopefully, as Chris mentioned, it's been voiced without reservation. Now, how do I enlarge upon that decision? I've got to enlarge upon that decision with action. He said, this was only a beginning. So the third step, vital and crucial step, but it is just a beginning. I've made a decision. We've talked about that, what that looks like, you know. If I've decided to do something, doesn't actually mean that I've done anything other than make a decision to do something. The time frames that I'm asked to then start to do the action starts at the bottom of page 63. And it starts with next. Well, there's the expectation of when do I start the work is next. That's straight away. He says, next, we launch. We talked a little bit about that last night. The language is, he uses language like launch, rocketed, catapulted, you know. If I think about how a rocket takes off from a launch pad, it doesn't use a little bit of energy and it meanders off. There's an extreme amount of energy that is expelled in order to get that massive equipment off the launch pad. And that's what I'm asked to do. I'm asked to do put in an effort here to launch into this course of vigorous action, which he suggested is the first step of personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. He says, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it would have little permanent effect, and he puts the time frame in again, unless at once, this is it, at once, followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor is but a symptom, so I needed to get down to the causes and the conditions. So step four is where I'm going to get down to the causes and the conditions. Step four is where I'm going to be able to face and be rid of the things in me that have been blocking me. Blocking me from what? Blocking me from this unsuspected inner resource, which he said I presently identify with my own conception of God. Step four is probably one of the most misunderstood, misconstrued steps of all of the steps. I can go to Google and I can start Googling up stuff and I'll come up on all sorts of things. I will find steps guides and worksheets and books. And I once came up on a guide to go through the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous that was like 550 odd pages long, and I think it was 100 pages that you had to read to actually work out how to use the guide. Now, I don't ever believe that it was meant to be that difficult. I don't ever believe that it was meant to be a Freudian exercise. You know, Dr. Bob said in his last talk, he said keep it simple. He said, don't louse it up. He said, don't spoil this thing with Freudian complexities, which may be interesting to the scientist, but has very little to do with our actual AA work. So this is not a Freudian exercise. The fourth step is a very, very simple, pragmatic tool that is to enable me to try and understand where my problems lie. The fourth step is a tool that I get to see how my self-centered, self-serving, self nature, it was out of whack and how it's caused me most of my problems. The second step talks about insanity. We detailed what insanity looks like. Insanity is that to believe that lie, the lack of proportion to the ability to think straight. I can't differentiate the true from the false. Insanity is not what I do when I drink, but it's that mental state that precedes a drink. And that's what we talk about, insanity. And if insanity is to believe a lie, then the four-step process is the tool by which I get to see the truth. And if I get to see the truth, then the truth will set me free. And that's actually a piece of scripture. It's from John 8 of 32. It says, "Then you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." That's actually etched and it's carved into the foyer of the entrance of the CIA building as their philosophy. Ye shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. So the four-step process is a process by which I get to see the truth. And when I get to see the truth, I'll be free. So the inventory process is the process by which I'm going to do that. I'm going to get Chris to read through some bits and pieces, but I want to try and highlight one of the most important instructions in this whole process is on the top of page 65 above his example. And he used these words. He said, "We are usually as definite as this example." I think that's the most underread, understated instruction for the whole four-step process. Is he says we are usually as definite as the example that he set down on this page here. Everything that we're going to read from here on, all of the instructions for the inventory processes are taken and transcribed word for word into the steps guide that you guys have got in front of you. So when I go through it and when we go through it and when I'm expected to do some writing, the information is going to be in the text in the handout. So, you know, hopefully it'll all mesh together with where we're at today. So did you want to...
I'll just reiterate what Pete said. I've seen more people get so confused with inventory by making it a Freudian exercise, and it was never meant to be a Freudian exercise. If you think in terms of why the book was written, and because there wasn't enough members at the time to carry the message out there into the world, so they wrote a book that supposedly any Tom, Dick and Harry could pick up and read and work his way through it without having something to explain. I've seen more people trying to explain the four-step and confused. It's a very, very simple, keep it very, very simple. It was never meant to be a complicated process. And if you can keep that in mind when you're going through it, it makes it much more simpler. And we'll explain, you know, we'll use the diagram that Bill uses in here, because I think it's a very, very cleverly written piece of information. It gives us all the clues, if you like, to get to that last bit that we're looking for. And so, it's a very, very... Keep it simple. It's a very, very simple thing. It was never meant to be a complex tool to try and parent my inner child or find out. It was never meant for that. It was meant to be a simple process that an alcoholic could pick up and go, well, okay, let me get to the truth about what's going on up here. Not find out the meaning of life.
All right. I want to start on
yep.
that.
Yep. So therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values.
All right. So he's telling me I need to take a personal inventory. And in order to try and explain a personal inventory, he says, well, maybe you probably know something about a business inventory. Everybody knows something about a business inventory, what they do. They do a bit of stock taking. They go and check stuff out. He says taking a commercial inventory is a fact finding. Well, I'm asked to do a searching. So, you know, I can use searching as fact-finding. So I'm asked to take a fact-finding, a searching, and fearless, a fact-facing. So I'm fact-finding and I'm fact-facing. I'm doing a searching and fearless. Inventory, which is a written list of items. What I'm looking for is I'm trying to discover the truth about the stock in trade. Now, in the text of the fourth step, he says, I did a searching and fearless moral inventory. And people sometimes, I can get that word a little bit out of shape, moral. I think, oh, geez, hang on, it's good, it's bad, it's this, it's that, it's so on. But if I tease moral out of a dictionary, I might come up with definitions like conveying or expressing the truth. Or even a better way to try and explain moral is when I'm telling a story. Well, the moral of the story was. And so when I'm talking about inventory and I'm taking a searching and fearless moral inventory, I'm doing it. The moral is the truth about the facts that I'm looking for. So I'm doing a fact-finding and fact-facing, truthful, written list of items. I'm trying to look for the crap. I'm trying to get the rubbish out so that something good can replace it. So I've always had this metaphor in my head. It doesn't matter what it might be. It could be I walk into a cool room. I jump on my forklift. I go into a warehouse. I'm looking for the stock in trade, the stuff that's there today, what's on the shelves today. I'm looking for the crap that's taken up room on the shelves, because what I want to do is I want to get that stuff off the shelves, get rid of it promptly and without regret. I can't fool myself that it might have been valuable at one point, but I've just got to get rid of it, and I've got to then leave room for something to replace it. If there's something in that warehouse that's been in that warehouse for 30 years, I need to deal with it, but if it ain't there, it ain't there. So that's what I'm asked to do. He says, we did exactly, not kind of, not sort of, not in a rough way. He said, we did exactly the same things with our lives. We took stock honestly. So what I'm doing is I'm looking for the stock in trade today. What is there today? I'm inventorying what is in my thinking today. I want to do a searching and fearless, truthful, moral, truthful list of items about what's in my thinking today. And the first one we're going to talk about is resentment. We searched out the flaws in our makeup. That's the defects of character which have caused my problems. Being convinced that self, like Chris talked about yesterday, that they manifested in various ways, which was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. I'm a self-gratifying, self-centered, egocentric, self-serving individual, and that's the thing that's caused me all of my problems. We're going to talk about three different kinds of inventories. The first one is the resentment inventory. The second one will be one on fears, and the third one is harms. He puts a lot of effort into explaining the resentment inventory to try and get me across the line. He gives us the example there. Did you want to read on? Read on.
So resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we've not only been mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles for whom we're angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambition, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we're sore, we'll burn up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example.
So he says resentment is the number one offender. He says it kills more alcohol, it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. He said from it, these resentments, stems every bit of spiritual disease that I'm probably going to have. He says, I haven't only been mentally and physically ill, but I've been spiritually off the beam. I've been spiritually unwell. And a lot of people, and I certainly was one of these that thought, well, hang on, I'll get well physically, I'll straighten out mentally, and I'll worry about that spiritual stuff down the track. And he said, You know, that's very wrong. What I need to do is when I sort out the spiritual malady, I'll straighten out in those other areas. He says, in dealing with resentments, and this is the first instruction. And on Bill's example, we're usually as definite as this example. He says, we listed people, institutions, or principles with whom I'm angry. It's not a hard task. It's a very pragmatic, very simple task. Stock in trade, I drive into the warehouse today, I'm thinking, right, who am I angry at? People, places, institutions that I'm angry at today. I'm still angry at someone from 20, it's today. That's still stock in trade. What's the stock in trade today? Where am I angry at these people? Now, I'm not asked to do anything else except to think about the people that I'm angry and I list them. And he listed them in column one. He says, I'm resentful at, that's the who. And he went through, he said, Brown, Jones, employer, wife. Bang, 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 just very simple. People, places, institutions with whom I'm angry. Once I finish that column, and I may pray to God, I might say, God, okay, well, show me the stock in trade. Show me the people, places, institutions with whom I am angry at. You know, don't forget that resentment is that resentment comes from the old word of resentire, which is to replay, refeel. I don't have a resentment straight away when you upset me now, but when I go home at the end of the day and I think about that, that's a resentment. Every time I replay that and refill it, I put it into the VCR machine, I rewind and replay it again. Every time I do that, you get worse and I get better. I become more of a victim for what you just done to me, and I replay it over and over and over. Stock in trade. Who am I angry at? Who have I got that going on with today? So I sit in column one and I finish column one from top to bottom. The second instructions, he says, we asked ourselves why we were angry. Why? The cause. He's put the cause there. I've gone through in my textbook and I've put a little dot between each sentence. They're like bullet points. He says his attention to my wife, told my wife of mistress, Bram might get a job at the office. You see, he didn't write a book here. I take it back to that first instruction that I talked about, which is the most important instruction that sits above that table. He says, we're usually as definite as his example. Chris and I have always said the challenge is 12 words, 10 words or less. The people come and they'll have reams and reams of... Great, but that's not where the object of the exercise is. I think that the best example of that is the example where he talks about the employer. He describes his employer as unreasonable, unjust, and overbearing. I'm sure he could have written a book as thick as the basic textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous of why he had that resentment, the cause of his resentment of he treated me badly and he promoted this person and he spoke, you know, that day and I got shunned for this job and I should have got this, and on and on and on and on. It's almost like the doctor's opinion. When he tried to describe and articulate what my problem is when I'm sober in abstinence, he used three words: restless, irritable, and discontent. And I said last night we could probably spend 8 hours just talking what restless, irritable, and discontent means. But in the inventory process, in order to try and get the cause down to bullet points, he used that unjust, unreasonable, overbearing example of how he felt about his boss. So I alongside each of those names, bullet point, I list the cause. 6 questions fills in that inventory process that he has outlined in those first 3 columns. I've marked up my book as that's 3 columns that he's got going there. The last column is that it affects mine. And he says... We asked ourselves why we were angry. He said in most cases it was found that our self-esteem, our ambitions, our personal relations were hurt, threatened, or were hurt, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. on our grudge list. So this is like what I do in the third column is that I list those injuries. Was it my self-esteem? Was it my security, my ambitions, personal or sex relationships which were interfered with? So the first column is I list. The second column is I ask why. And the third column is where was I hurt, threatened, injured or interfered with? Six questions completes that inventory that is outlined there. This is not a difficult process. You know, this is a process that is very pragmatic. It's very black and white. It's very misconstrued. It doesn't need to be autobiographical. I don't go to the start of the fifth step where it talks about that until we tell somebody all our life story. That is not an instruction for how I do inventory. When he talks about that instruction there, it's that I share all my life story with reference to what I've written here. But that's not an instruction for how do I write this. The instruction for how I write this is very clear. I keep it in bullet points. I list who hurt, threatened, injured, or interfered with. List cause, hurt, threatened, or interfered with, and that completes this page here. Do we want to jump at the bottom and
yep.
Go over? We went back through.
So we went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived.
So I go back through my life, I look for that stock in trade, I've been fearless and thorough, I've done a searching and fearless, I've fact-finded and fact-faced, I've looked at those things, I've got that down in that template, I've finished and completed those first three columns as he's outlined in his example. And over the page, it's very obvious to me, and it always has been, I wouldn't have had to do inventory to tell you this, but people just don't treat me very well. It's their fault. So to conclude that others were wrong was as far as I ever got. Be very sure. I am not highly educated. I do not have a university degree, but what I have is a degree in being able to blame others. I am an expert. I can turn anything into your fault. Doesn't matter. It is an art form. None of you guys have that, I'm sure, but I have that. I am so good at it. And this process that he's outlined there, it's really nothing new. I've always known who I didn't like. I could have told you why I don't like them. I could have given you some backhanded answer or excuse for or reason why I don't like them. Oh, he took my girlfriend. I lost my job. Oh, that's sex relations. Oh, that's your material security. I wouldn't have been able to articulate those terms, but there's no new information so far that's come out. What that information has enabled me to do, what it's done up until this point, is that it's caused remorse and I'm sore at myself. I'm full of self-pity. Just have a look at this stuff. I mean, Jesus, look what these people have done. I mean, how I've been treated. I mean, I could sell this stuff to you. You know, I could round up a few guys and I could say, hey, listen, you want to read this with me? See this bloke? Look what he did to me. I'll get a posse of people around me. You'll go, he did what? To you? Really? Maybe we can go and square up. You see what I'm saying? I can use this as a tool to gather people on my side. And that guy really needs a serious talking to. I mean, like, I think that would fix the situation. You see, because I'm a victim. They did this to me. It's their fault. It's not my fault. If only they treated me better, I'd be okay. We talked about yesterday, the actor. You know, if only the rest of the world would behave, if only people would do as I wished, if only I got what I wanted, you know, the world would be great. Life would be wonderful. But I'm full of this stuff, and I don't see it that way. And what it is that I'm quite caught up. You know, The more I fought and tried to have my own way, the worse matters got. The more I tried to exert my self-will, the more I tried to exert myself more to get the world to conform to me, all I did was step on the toes of people and they retaliated and caused more problems. The more I tried to fix the problem with the very thing that caused the problem just continues to spiral and get worse. I can't fix the thing that's broken with the thing that's broken, but God, I'll give it a damn good try. And it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. It says, you know, in war, the victor only seemed to win. You know, sometimes I think I'm winning here, but that's in italics, you know. That's the delusion, you know. I just can't see the truth about that. I think I'm getting away with this, and I'm thinking I'm winning by gathering that posse and let's go and beat up on that person or whatever it is, and it just doesn't work, you know. He says, our moments of triumph were short-lived. So no new information here. This is old information. It's the tool by which I've justified to you endless drinking because I'm a victim of what they did to me. And I need to somehow move to a different place. I need to somehow come to terms with seeing that through a different lens, to wear a new pair of glasses, to change my angle of approach in how I see, live and face this world.
So the worst thing about resentment is that it gives me a false sense of power. It's a delusion of power. You see, I think if I hate you, that I'm winning the war over you. But ultimately, I'm the one that's killing. It's not killing you. It's a delusion of power. And so I've got to get down to see that it's not power at all. It's actually killing me. I think I'm winning the war, but I'm not winning the war.
Judge.
Yeah. So it's plain that life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile. But with the alcoholic whose hopes is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harbouring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for the alcoholic, these things are poison.
So, these things lead only to futility and unhappiness in my life. You know, to the extent that I allow these resentments to happen in my life, I absolutely squander any worthwhile time in my life. I just completely burn it to the ground. But as an alcoholic, my only hope is through the maintenance and growth of this spiritual experience, of this vital spiritual change, this personality change sufficient to bring this entire psychic change, the stuff we've talked about in the solution. My only hope and salvation is going to be experiencing that in my life. But he says that having these resentments is infinitely grave. And he says we found it as fatal. He says, what happens is that I become shut off from the sunlight of the spirit. I'm blocked. And we talked about that this whole process of the weekend, the whole process of going through the steps is not to try and find a power out here. I need to become unblocked to have access to something that's within me. You know, the metaphor of that I'm shut off from the sunlight of the spirit is that, you know, I need to sit by that window and I need to bathe in the sunlight that comes through that window and I need to experience that sunshine. And that's the metaphor of that I need to be in God's presence. I need to sit in that. But when I have resentments, what I'm doing is I'm pulling close the blind and I start to sit in darkness. And as I sit in darkness, I'm full of me again. And for as long as I'm full of me again, I start to become restless, irritable and discontent. And when I'm restless, irritable and discontent, my brain looks for a sense of ease and comfort. It starts to look for a solution. What solves that? I go back to that tested and tried proven formula for removing those feelings, and it was called drinking. And little bit by little bit, if I sit in that long enough, the insanity of alcohol returns and I end up drinking. I need to somehow get that blind open. I need to somehow be able to sit in that sunlight of the spirit. I got a quick little story. I remember I was helping a guy one time and he said to me, he said, I made a time to do his fifth step. And I usually do most of the fifth steps in the area where I live now in the same spot. And I said, well, you meet me there at 8 o'clock or whatever it's going to be on a Sunday morning. And we made a time, and I wanted to get it done. I'd made the time, and I wanted to get through it with him. And that was fine. It was going to happen. And then my family said, oh, we're going to Geelong. We're going down to Geelong for the day. We're going to go down there and go to the beach and so on and so forth. And I thought, well, I've got this commitment. I'm going to help this guy. I said, I'll come down after this commitment. No big deal. And then I thought, oh, gee, I really don't want to miss out. I want to go down there with the family. And I thought, but I've made a commitment. I make a commitment. Chris said last night, when you ask to do something, you say yes. You know. And I thought, well, I've made this commitment to this guy. I said, all right, well, let me try something on here. So I rang him up. I said, hey, mate, tomorrow. I said, can we meet a bit earlier? He said, yeah, what are you thinking? I said, how about 4? When we say prepared to go to any length, we mean any length. His immediate response was, yeah, no problem. So anyway, we get down there, I'm in my car, I'm facing this way, east is that direction, I've got the interior light on my car, he's sitting beside me and we're reading through it. 4 o'clock in the morning, it's pitch black. We're going through this and he's reading his inventory to me. And little bit by little bit, you know, we're going through it, we're getting through it and so on and so forth, and east is that direction, and as the sun starts to come up and I've turned off the light, and never before was that metaphor of being in the sunlight of the Spirit in practical terms of what happened in that car. Because as he was getting rid of his inventory and sharing his inventory with me, all of a sudden we were both sitting in the sunlight of the Spirit, and it just happened in practical terms. You see, that's where I need to get. That's where I need to be, is that I need to be unblocked and to be able to bathe in that sunshine or the light of the Spirit within me and not have things that are blocking me. And so far, everything that we've talked about in those three columns that I've just gone through are completely blocking me. I'm sitting in darkness, that curtain's pulled down. I need to somehow get those blinds open, but how? I'm a victim, you know? It doesn't matter whether the resentments are justifiable or unjustifiable, whether they are fancied or real, whether they happened or they didn't happen, whether they were actual or not, it doesn't matter. The debate here is, can I afford to have resentments? Am I a person? He says in the 12 and 12 that resentments should be left to people who can handle them, non-alcoholics. You know? But I can't. I just can't handle resentment. That's the dubious luxury of normal people. But for me, it's poison. I just cannot handle resentments. I need to somehow be able to reconcile them. So, I need to somehow get to the next part to learn to pragmatically deal with this in a different way than I have up to now.
We turn back to the list for held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We begin to see that the world and its people really dominate us. In that state of wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realised that people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way that they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat a sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chances of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. Where have we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other persons involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory is ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. We admit our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight.
Okay. So, this is where the pivot happens. This is the game changer. This is where I get to to see the truth, to become free. Our sponsor has an email address that is AA 180 degree turn. This is where the 180 degree turn happens. This is where I get to see things differently. This is where I go from being the prosecutor to be on the defence team. He said, we turn back to the list. The list, I've got the list. The people, places, institutions, the cause, where was I hurt, threatened, injured or interfered with. I've got that made up. It's not difficult, bullet point. There's no new information in that. And spent a lot of time in that third. Well, was it myself? Could it be my personal? You can knock yourself out. But again, it's a stepping stone to getting to that last column, because it's the last column that is the game changer. He says, it's got the key. I'm prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. Just to be smart, just to be mealy mouth, but looked up entirely, absolutely, completely, totally, wholly. That's what I'm asked to do. To look at it from an entirely different angle. I began to see that the world and the people really dominate us. Chris used to always say, you know, I have resentments thinking that I'm going to drink alcohol and now the person's going to die. And it just doesn't work that way, because that's what's going on. I resent people. And the people that I resent have actually got a gun to my head. I've got the gun to my head through my resentment to those people, and they have the power to actually kill me through my resentment that I have on them. They're asleep. The irony is they don't even know. But I know. And it makes me, it shuts me off from the sunlight of the Spirit, that whole metaphor. He said that the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real, had that power to actually kill. Doesn't matter whether these things are fancied or real, whether I was a victim of some heinous sexual reaction with whether it happened or not is not the issue here. The debate is, am I a person who can tolerate living with resentment? And if I've got to this place, I understand that I'm not. And I understand the consequences and the route and where I'm going to go with it if I continue with it. It says that these resentments have to be mastered, but how? I can't wish these resentments away any more than I could alcohol. I couldn't wish not to be an alcoholic, and I can't wish these resentments to go away. This was our course. And this is the absolute game changer. He said, we realised that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Oh, yeah. I can buy that. You know what? You can probably sell that to me. Maybe some of these people who wronged me were perhaps spiritually sick. Maybe everybody's perhaps a little spiritually sick. Maybe if I think about the fact that maybe there's not good and bad people in the world, maybe there are just different degrees of spiritually unwell people. I think the most heinous criminal is not bad, but perhaps further spiritually sick on the spiritual spectrum than somebody else. I don't believe there's good and bad. I think there's spiritually sick, different levels of people. So maybe the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. You know what? I can buy that. Yep, I'm okay with that. Though I did not like their symptoms, the stuff that I saw in the second column, what they did, the bullet points that I came up with in the second column, they did this, they did that, they treated me whatever, the boss, the what, the girl, the this. Though I don't like their symptoms and the way these affected me, the stuff I see in the third column, you know what? I didn't like any of that stuff. He says, they, and here's a bit of a kick in the teeth, he said, they, like ourselves, damn, I thought I was off the hook here. They, like ourselves, were sick too. See, I'm not out of the equation. He's saying they're spiritually sick, but so am I. Them, just like me, is spiritually sick. He said, there's a prayer. He said, we ask God to help us, to help me, show them the same tolerance, pity and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. I'm to pray for these people. I'm to to show them the same tolerance, patience and pity that I would grant a sick friend. In the original manuscript, there was a few words that followed that, and he said, a person who has cancer. How would I treat a person who has cancer? I wouldn't be angry at him, I'd feel sorry for him. That poor guy, look, he's got cancer. But I can't look at a spiritually sick person that way, but that was taken out. But that's what I'm asked to do. I'm asked to treat that person as a spiritually sick person. We call this this little component the sick man's prayer, or the tolerance prayer, or when a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? Can I be helpful to this person by being angry at him? Probably not. He said, God save me from anger, thy will be done. See, that person may have done better had they known better, but maybe they were doing the best they could. As I said, I believe that people are spiritually unwell, that they're doing the best they can with the amount of God they've got in their heart. If they had more God in their heart, they would do better. He says, we avoid retaliation. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. I destroy my chance of being helpful if I'm going to be angry at them. He said, I can't be helpful to all people. I ask God how I can take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one of them. So now I'm referring back to the list. And this is where I'm going from this side of the diagram, looking at it from the first three columns, and I'm prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. And I'm standing, if I've just done a whiteboard, as we've done a million times, and I've just gone through it all, and I've started on that side, now I'm going to walk over to this side of the whiteboard, and I'm going to look from this direction. I'm going to stand in that last column, I'm going to look in that direction. After I've prayed and I've done that sick man's prayer and kindly and tolerant view, this is a sick man, how I can be helpful to him, and I'm going to try and answer some questions here. He says, referring to my list again and putting out of the minds the others had done. So you know what? I'm going to put a piece of paper right across those first three columns because I don't care. That ain't about them. This is about me. It's not about what they did. It's about It's not about what they did, but it could have been what I did at the time or how I've thought about what they've done since, how I've replayed and refilled it. He said, I'm looking for my own mistakes. I'm resolutely looking for my own mistakes. I'm looking for my own mistakes here. He says, where had I been? Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking and frightened. He says, though a situation had not been entirely my fault, I tried to disregard that other person entirely. Disregarding the other person entirely. Absolutely, completely, totally, wholly. There's language. And a lot of guys know where I'm going with this because they've heard it 100 times. And I've said it once, I'll say it 50,000 times, yet people still say it. They think, what I need to do here is I need to see my part. I need to get to my part here. What's my part in something? Let me tell you, I told you before that I have a degree in blame. I'm a good blamer, and I can distribute blame very well. And if I'm looking for my part in anything, you know what? If this is the resentment, you know, that's my part there. But that's you. It's still your fault, and I'm still a victim. This is why I behave the way I behave, because look what you did to me. Okay, look, I might have a couple of things here I might have done wrong, but come on. It doesn't say my part. It says I've got to disregard the other person involved entirely. This is my inventory, not the other person's. I take them completely out of the picture, and I'm asked to look at where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, where was I frightened? It was my inventory. There was a part that we read yesterday, just to try and validate that. He says, admitting he may be somewhat at fault. Okay, I can admit I can be somewhat at fault. I am sure that others are more to blame. This is not where we're going. I've got to disregard the other person involved entirely. I've got to see this from a different angle. I've got to Even the most heinous crimes that might have been perpetrated against me, somehow I've got to come to terms that maybe they were perpetrated by somebody who was spiritually unwell, just like me. I've got to do that prayer. I've got to pray to show them tolerance, patience, and pity. Maybe I've got to think of things like this, like the Lord's Prayer that says, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us." You see, I've caused problems. Maybe I've got to forgive other people who've caused problems. Now I've got the ability to do that because I get to see them as a sick person. So if I'm still holding on to a resentment against that sick person, my wrong, the exact nature of my wrong is I'm dishonest. Because I'm not seeing them as a sick person. The minute that I can say, guy's a sick person. Maybe he was doing as good as he could. Maybe if he knew better, he would have done better. Maybe he would have, you know. You see, if I'm sitting down and I'm going through a fifth step with a guy, I'm looking at that first resentment. I'll spend a little bit of time on that first resentment with him because I think that it helps with all of the rest of them when he's sitting and he's sharing with it. And hopefully the one at the top's the worst one. It's the father, it's the mother, it's the perpetrator, some heinous whatever. And I spend a lot of time in the last column trying to drill down on that. You know, and I might say things like, well, let's just imagine here just for a moment. We're at 10. I'm just going to, a couple more minutes and we're out of here. Just imagine for a moment that, I know I'm sitting here listening to your inventory here, but let's just suppose this person in column one, I'm actually sitting with that person in column one. They're sitting down and they're sharing their inventory with me. And the person that they're talking about in their inventory is you. And in the second column, they're telling me, in bullet point format, they're telling me exactly what you did. What would they be telling me? What would they be telling me? Would they be telling me that you were the best son, that you were the best this, that you were the best employee, that you were a model citizen? You know, sometimes it might take that for me to get to try and get that point across. And it helped me when I was going through inventory, it helped me to think, well, I'm never interested in them. I don't care about them. All I care about is that they treated me badly. I'm a victim of what they did. I don't care that they survived the war, that they came back and their father had post-traumatic stress disorder and he used to beat up their mother and he was a drunk and he came home and kicked the dog and the person who I'm sharing the inventory with. See, I don't care about anybody else. You see, my eyes are turned in this way. They're not turned out that way. I'm a selfish, self-centered, self-serving individual. I'm only concerned about me. And when I can slowly but surely work through that in that last column and say, well, maybe that person was doing the best they could. Maybe if I wasn't so damn selfish and I wasn't so much thinking about me and I considered that, well, I wonder what made that person do those things. What possibly could have happened in that person's life that caused them to do the thing to me that they did that I've got this resentment on? And little bit by little bit, that enables me to get to see the truth. Maybe I don't have the ability to see them as a spiritually sick individual. Then my defect of character is dishonest, because if I could see them as a spiritually sick person and look at it honestly, they were doing as good as they could. Now, the last column is the column by which I get the tools to see the truth. And when I see it and I read it back the other way, that the dishonesty caused me to see that whole thing in the wrong direction, the resentment comes undone. I can't sit in that last column and answer it honestly and get through that last column and still have resentments at the end of the day. Because, one, I can't afford to, I get blocked off from the sunlight of the Spirit. But if I follow the very simple pragmatic instructions of looking for my wrongs, not my part, but the exact nature of my wrongs, of where was I at fault, I finish that last column and all of a sudden all those people on the list are no longer on the list as far as resentments go. Because I'm not going to get to the end of the chapter now, but I've listed and analysed my resentments. I've listed and I've undone them via this simple, pragmatic process. Anderson, want to go?
So Pete said at the start, you know, when I get to see the truth will set me free. And ultimately that last column is where I start to see the truth about the situation, because I've looked at it from a warped perspective. And we talked about yesterday, the lack of power was my dilemma. If I could just master these resentments like that, just go, well, I'll think of them as a sick person, it'll just go away. I can't do that. I don't have the needed power to do that. And that's why that prayer, the sick man's prayer, is so important. Often we skip over, go, oh yes, it's a prayer, I'll just quickly say the prayer and move on to the last goal. And it's such an important thing to move me in that position to look at it from an entirely different angle. And it's the game changer. I think, you know, for a lot of times I miss that. I was just in a hurry to get to that last column and not looking at it from a different angle because I want to fill it out and move on. But ultimately, that's where it starts to change. When I can start to look at it from an entirely different angle, they melt away. Most of them melt away because I start to see the truth in what it is. And most of my resentments, and there's a puncher to the ego, most of them were fancy. They weren't even real. I'm not saying that there's not real ones there, but a majority of my resentments were just crap my head was telling me. And that's a rude awakening.